Basically, what I want to speak about this morning is the way in which it seems to me, and to a number of philosophers who don't consider themselves theists, that the phenomenon of consciousness, and more generally phenomena associated with mind, just seem to be really ill at ease with the metaphysical worldview of naturalism. So I've slightly provocatively titled this session, Reason and Consciousness, Naturalism's Achilles Heel. It does seem to me that consciousness and reason are really difficult to square with metaphysical naturalism, such that I think we see all sorts of ways in which secular discourse presupposes that we are conscious and that we have minds that are able to refer to the external world and that our minds can reliably represent external reality. And as I'm going to suggest in the next half an hour, all of these things are really difficult to square with naturalism. And one way I like to think of it is in terms of a kind of dilemma that naturalism faces. So naturalism has always been a bit elastic as to what is naturalism? What does it mean for something to be a natural phenomenon? So it seems to me that either you go the really sort of strict, hardcore naturalist route, someone like Daniel Dennett would be a good representative of this, really sort of biting the bullet, as it were, and really holding to the idea that all that there is whatever physics ends up saying are the most fundamental constituents of physical reality, that's all there is, and anything else is just an illusion. Okay, and now I think it's fair to say not many people can live with that, arguably including the people who espouse it. It's not clear that they consistently stick to that. I mean, Dennett uses first-person pronouns throughout his books. So either you go the strict naturalist route and eliminate all of these phenomena, which arguably are the things we are most well acquainted with in this world, or you go the route of what you could call broad naturalism and you stretch what it means to be a naturalist, I would suggest, to breaking point, so that you can have these wonderful things, conscious experiences, intentionality, not that I'm going to be talking about this, but also objective moral values and so on. You kind of have your cake and eat it. You broaden naturalism out so that you can fit these things in, but then it's really unclear in what sense you're a naturalist anymore. So that seems to me to be a kind of fundamental dilemma. So C.S. Lewis, I think had really good instincts on this. Lewis was always very modest and claimed not to be a philosopher, but I think some of his insights were really on point and have been picked up in the last couple of decades by a number of philosophers who've developed arguments that are in the spirit of some of the things he was wanting to say. So Lewis, in his book Miracles, he has a chapter in which he basically makes this argument that naturalism is kind of self-defeating because a thoroughgoing naturalistic account of the mind seems to undermine the very reasoning, the very rational faculties that we would have to use to arrive at a naturalistic worldview. So this is what he says. Naturalism goes on claiming territory after territory, first the inorganic, then the lower organisms, then man's body, then his emotions. But when it takes the final step and we attempt a naturalistic account of thought itself, suddenly the whole thing unravels. The last fatal step has invalidated all the preceding ones, for they were all reasonings, and reason itself has been discredited. So I think Lewis was really onto something here. And so I think it's good to start by getting a bit of a handle on what naturalism is, and I think the best way to do that is by looking to what some prominent naturalists of the last century have said. So let's start with John Searle. So John Searle was a professor of philosophy at Berkeley, And this is, he's not actually trying to give a definition of naturalism, but he very clearly, this is his kind of picture of the world, and he is undoubtedly a naturalist. So he says that the world consists entirely of entities that we find it convenient, though not entirely accurate, to describe as particles. These particles exist in fields of force and are organized into systems. Examples of systems are mountains, planets, H2O molecules, rivers, crystals, and babies. So everything falls within the scope of this claim about what reality is composed of. Richard Rorty makes it very explicit how this shakes out in terms of mental phenomena. So he says, every speech, thought, theory, poem, composition, and philosophy will turn out to be completely predictable in purely naturalistic terms. Some atoms in the void account of microprocesses within individual human beings will permit the prediction of every sound or inscription which will ever be uttered. So what's Rorty saying here? Well, he seems to be saying that everything, even those things we typically associate with the realm of the mental, the mind, so rational thought, feeling, imagination, and so on, will in the end be accounted for solely in terms of the motions of physical particles. And those physical particles themselves are presumably lacking consciousness, rational thought, and feeling. So whatever physicists eventually end up concluding are the most fundamental physical particles, naturalism wants to say that those fundamental physical particles are the building blocks out of which everything is made. So I used to love Lego as a kid, still secretly do. And so I think a helpful and if not slightly rough and ready analogy for the naturalistic picture of reality is basically you have a pile of Lego blocks, and these represent the fundamental constituents of physics, and the only things that can exist are things that can in some way be composed out of some arrangement of those fundamental physical building blocks. Anything else is to be deemed as illusory or unreal. Okay, so putting all of this together, I think we can say that naturalism consists in at least the following two claims. So firstly, that everything that exists is ultimately built out of the most basic building blocks of physics. And secondly, that those basic building blocks of physics are themselves lacking in consciousness, purpose, and value. So somehow, if we're going to have consciousness in the picture, it's got to be somehow built out of these fundamental constituents. Okay, so what I want to do then is suggest that there are three particularly striking phenomena that we are all very well acquainted with. And I'm going to suggest that all of them are very difficult to square with this ontology, this picture of what reality is composed of. And the phenomena that I want to talk about are conscious experience as such, what philosophers call qualia, subjective experiences. Secondly, intentionality or aboutness, the way that thoughts are able to represent things outside of themselves. And thirdly, cognitive reliability, the capacity our minds have for not only representing, having thoughts that represent the world, but that represent the world accurately. Okay, let's zoom in on each of these. Conscious experience as such. So as I said, philosophers use the term qualia to talk about conscious experience as such. And the idea here is we're not talking about necessarily something very sophisticated like the kind of self-awareness that humans have, though of course those are included, but even the kinds of experiences such as they are that bats or mice might have. The point is that there is something it is like to be me, to be you, and indeed to be a bat. So Thomas Nagel, this gentleman on the left, extremely prominent philosopher in the 20th century, was still alive. And Thomas Nagel has a famous essay called What's It Like to Be a Bat? And one of the points he makes in that essay is just that conscious experience, unlike any other phenomenon that we try to study, be it lightning or weather patterns, unlike any other phenomenon that we've tried to study scientifically, conscious experience seems to be the kind of thing that cannot be grasped without knowing it from the inside. We can't know what it's like to be a bat. And that seems to be because, bats have this sense, echolocation. They navigate their way around the world using a sensory organ that is extremely different to anything that we have. It just seems as though, we can study bat neurophysiology endlessly. And so long as we are, we have no sensory organ that is anything like echolocation, we just can't know what it is like to be a bat, to have a subjective experience of navigating our way around the world with echolocation. So there seems to be this fundamental gap between the scientific picture that is conducted in terms of third person description and that irreducibly first person subjective experience of the world. So, of course, neuroscience has made enormous leaps and bounds in the last few decades. Neuroscience is able to give us increasingly detailed accounts of what is going on in the brain when, for example, someone is experiencing pain or experiencing fear or even, experiencing the taste of coffee versus the taste of tea and so on. But this is something that the Australian philosopher David Chalmers has pointed out, that all of these questions that neuroscience is answering, what's going on in the brain when someone feels fear, these are what Chalmers calls the easy problem of consciousness, the problem of finding correlations between brain activity and conscious experience. He doesn't mean to denigrate the work of neuroscience. Obviously, it's challenging, but in principle, we know how to do that. But it's all of that says nothing at all to what Chalmers calls the hard problem of consciousness. The question of why is it that activity, neural firings going on in this this kind of piece of meat, why is it that these physical goings on are accompanied by this very different kind of thing, namely subjective experience? And as Chalmers has argued at length, it seems like neuroscience isn't even trying to answer that question. For all the claims that are sometimes made by neuroscientists to have finally unlocked the secret of why there's such thing as consciousness. Always that when they say that, they are talking about the easy problem of consciousness. Frank Jackson, another Australian philosopher, actually, Frank Jackson gave this he had this famous paper in 1986 called What Mary Didn't Know. And what Jackson argues in that paper is that property, what it's like to experience the color red, for example, the mental state, seems not to be any physical thing in the world. And the way he argues that is through a thought experiment. So he asks us to imagine that there's this brilliant scientist called Mary. And Mary, for whatever reason, this is an analytic philosophy thought experiment. We don't ask these kind of questions. Mary, for some reason, grows up in a black and white world where she never experiences any color. Okay, and she gains a complete physical understanding of the neurophysiology of seeing red. She knows exactly what's going on in the brain when someone sees red. But one day Mary sees red for herself for the first time. And it seems very intuitive that Mary learns something new. She learns what it's like to see red. But The point is that she already knew all of the physical facts about what's involved in the brain, what's going on in the brain when someone sees red. And so it seems like the thing that she learns, namely what it's like to experience the quality of redness, is not a physical property of the world. Now, you can, if you don't like because philosophers have made distinctions between primary and secondary qualities and so on. If you don't like this particular way of framing the thought experiment, you could make it about pain. So Mary has a complete neurophysiological understanding of what's going on in the brain when someone stubs their toe really hard. Mary herself has never experienced such pains. And then one day she does. It seems like she's now newly acquainted with what it's like to feel pain upon stubbing your toe. And the same point again can be made. Okay, let's talk about intentionality or aboutness. So let's just illustrate this with a simple example. So think about the Statue of Liberty pictured here on the left. Okay, and you know, just hold that image in your mind. It's actually quite amazing when you reflect on it, what's going on here. There is somehow a thought in our minds that is representing or is about this physical object that is, what, 4,000 miles away. And what's more, it represents some true things about that object, namely that it's green, that it's, you know, fairly tall, has a spiky crown, is holding a flaming torch aloft, and so on. So in short, intentionality is that quality that our thoughts, our mental states have of being about something other than themselves. It's that quality of representing the world or of having content. Okay, the third thing that I want to talk about is cognitive reliability. So in order for us to have knowledge about the world, it's not enough that we can have qualia, it's not enough that we can have subjective experience. We also need to be able to have mental states that can be about things outside themselves, but more than that is needed still for us to have knowledge. Because, of course, I could have the thought that the Statue of Liberty is red. That would be a thought that is about the world, but it's an inaccurate representation of the world. So we need more than just those first two things in order to have knowledge of the world. We also need reliable cognitive faculties. What do I mean by cognitive faculties? Well, things like vision, hearing, memory, rational intuition, and so on. So to have a reliable faculty of vision would mean that most of the time your visual experiences, your impressions about the color, shape, distance of objects in your vicinity are accurate representations of the world. So what I want to do now is walk you through why it seems to me that naturalism has a really hard time accommodating these three phenomena. Okay, so I kind of sketched the case for thinking that qualia, subjective experiences, are irreducible to physical brain states. So, you know, even though we may be able to arrive at a very detailed physical account of what's going on in the brain when someone sees red, as David Chalmers points out, that doesn't seem to answer the question of why those physical brain states are accompanied by that first person sensation. Now, couldn't the naturalist claim, as some naturalists do, that, well, just give neuroscience enough time and we'll be able to figure out the answer to that question? I'm inclined to think that doesn't work. And the reason is that it seems to be fundamental to what neuroscience is, that it is striving to give accounts of the world in third-person terms, in terms that do not refer to a conscious subject, a first-person perspective. So it tries to give explanations of reality, specifically reality pertaining to the physical brain, in terms of third-person descriptions that necessarily leave out any kind of first-person perspective. And so it seems to me that any attempt to, for example, explain the experience of seeing red, that leaves out that first person's perspective will have failed to capture what is essential to the experience of seeing red. So I should just pause and flag something. So does all of this kind of presuppose substance dualism, the idea that there is a not just that mental states are non-physical properties, but that there is a non-physical substance. Perhaps you want to give it the label the soul. Now, as it happens, I am a substance dualist. represent. but I actually don't think that the points I'm making here rely on substance dualism being true. It would be enough for what philosophers call property dualism to be true. And that's the position that those three philosophers I mentioned earlier, Nagel, Chalmers, Jackson, or Jackson used to be a property dualist, that's a long story. The idea that mental states are non-physical properties, what it is that bears those properties is sort of a separate question. But so I don't think one needs to be a substance dualist to make this case that mental states, that quality of what it's like to experience red, is very difficult to square with naturalism. So it seems really to me that that naturalists have the following kind of two options. As I said, I'm sort of making the case broadly that naturalism faces this kind of dilemma. And in the case of qualia, it faces this dilemma. So either you kind of really bite the bullet and deny the reality of qualia. And there are some philosophers who take this route, Daniel Dennett, Paul Churchland. I think most philosophers think that is mad. I think it is mad. Most philosophers who are not theists at all think that is just crazy. Surely, qualia are the things that we are most well acquainted with in all of reality. And then the other option, and this is the option that is taken by people like Thomas Nagel, is to sort of say, well, qualia are real, but it's just a kind of brute fact of the universe of which there is no deeper explanation. It's just a brute fact that when you get certain complex arrangements of physical matter, you get these subjective experiences that come along with them. And there's no deeper story as to why that is. It's just a brute fact of the universe. And that is, it seems to me, not very satisfying. It kind of leaves qualia as this dangling phenomena that are really without a home. And I don't think it yields a very satisfying kind of metaphysical picture overall. Okay, let's talk about intentionality and why it's hard to square with naturalism. So I think that the basic thought here is that if the thoughts in our heads are actually nothing more than the interactions of physical particles, how can they be about anything? How can they have content? Presumably this lectern is not about anything. It's just a bunch of, particles, physical particles. And it doesn't seem obvious at all why just having a more complex configuration of physical particles would change that situation. And this is a difficulty that's acknowledged even by the prominent naturalist philosopher who we encountered earlier, John Searle. And he says that so far, no attempt at naturalizing intentional content has produced an explanation of intentional content that is even remotely plausible. That's quite a strong statement. And so for Searle, he just says it's just a brute fact. Again, a bit like with the second horn of the dilemma with qualia. John Searle just says it's just a brute fact that there is this property of intentionality. Now, at this point, you might be sensing a potential objection to what I've just said, because after all, you are looking at pixels and maybe pieces of paper with ink on them, and these, I think we'd all agree, are physical things, right? But don't they seem to be about things? So it looks like according to this objection, it looks like physical stuff, pixels, ink on pieces of paper, has this quality of aboutness. So what's the problem with saying that physical brains can have that too? Well, that's much too fast. So just think about these words on the left of the screen, Statue of Liberty. Okay, it's made up of pixels, presumably. Now, what do these shapes, what do these letters, what do these arrangements of physical matter have to do with the object that's 4,000 miles away? Any thoughts? How is it that they represent the physical object 4,000 miles away? Absolutely, our use of it. Yeah, so I think the thing that binds together all of those points is that it is about us. We have, albeit implicitly, collectively agreed that these arrangements of matter are going to represent that physical object. So there is nothing intrinsic to that physical arrangement of matter that it has any connection with the Statue of Liberty. It's because we have implicitly agreed that that's what these symbolically represent. So in other words, the intentionality of these letters is derivative of our intentionality. So it doesn't get the naturalist any further forward to try and make this move. Okay, let's talk finally then about why cognitive reliability is a problem for naturalism. So the American philosopher Alvin Plantinga, one of the most distinguished philosophers of the last 50 years, has developed an argument for thinking that if naturalism is true, then our cognitive faculties are not likely to be reliable. Okay, so what Plantinga wants to say here is that if our minds, if our cognitive faculties are faculties of vision, hearing, but arguably even more importantly of inference, the ability to take a bunch of premises and move either deductively or inductively to some conclusion, and our faculty of rational intuition and so on, that there, if all of this has been built by an unguided evolutionary process that wasn't aiming to give us truth-directed faculties, then it's not likely that process has given us truth-directed faculties. Now, just to be clear, this isn't an argument against evolution as such. It's an argument against the conjunction of evolution and naturalism. So it's an argument against unguided naturalistic evolution, which is presumably how our minds would have originated if naturalism were true. Now, what's really interesting is that some notable atheist philosophers, or indeed naturalist philosophers, have said things which seem very much to support what Plantinga is claiming. So here's Patricia Churchland, strong naturalist philosopher, and she has written that, boiled down to essentials, a nervous system enables the organism to succeed in feeding, fleeing, fighting, and reproducing. The principal chore of nervous systems is to get the body parts where they should be in order that the organism may survive. And this is the really key line. Truth, whatever that is, definitely takes the hindmost. Here's Thomas Nagel. Thomas Nagel says that if we came to believe that our capacity for objective theory, that is for true beliefs about the world, were the product of natural selection, that would warrant serious skepticism about its results. That's very interesting. So why exactly is it that unguided evolution would be unlikely to produce creatures with reliable cognitive faculties? Well, the thought is just that natural selection weeds out those creatures who are less effective at propagating their genes. Creatures who are more effective at navigating their way around their environment in order to find food, shelter, mates, and so on, are more likely to pass on their genes. And so what natural selection is ultimately selecting for is propensity towards adaptive behavior. And what Plantinga wants to say is that there's no necessary connection at all between having a largely true set of beliefs and having dispositions to behave in adaptive ways. Okay, so let's kind of take stock. So I've tried to suggest that there are a sort of cluster or family of phenomena, if you like, that all have to do with mind, to do with the realm of the mental, that are very difficult to square with naturalism. And I've sort of framed this at the big picture level in terms of a dilemma. So either naturalists naturalists basically just deny the reality of these phenomena, they just eliminate them, and kind of bite the bullet in a way that I think is unpalatable even to most non-theists, or they kind of try to accommodate these phenomena by claiming that they are just brute facts of the universe, that qualia just come along whenever you have sufficiently complex arrangements of physical brains. And it's just a sort of brute law of reality that qualia will accompany these physical arrangements of matter. Or that intentionality, this quality thoughts have of being about things other than themselves, it's just a brute fact. That thoughts are able to do this, and so on. And so it seems to me that this option really stretches naturalism to breaking point, such that it's not clear to me what it is that really makes this worthy of the title, worthy of the label naturalism. And it is interesting that a number of philosophers of mind, who are certainly not believers in God, are persuaded that these sorts of phenomena I've been talking about, especially qualia, one has to take them seriously. One can't eliminate them, and so they are abandoning at least strict forms of naturalism and are starting to explore worldviews that look like they're edging a bit closer to theism. Philip Goff is a philosopher of mind at Durham University, and he has been advocating a worldview or metaphysical picture called panpsychism, the idea that in some sense all physical matter is conscious to some degree, and that consciousness is an irreducible and fundamental feature of reality. As I said, Thomas Nagel himself also thinks that consciousness is fundamental and irreducible. And he has a kind of picture of the world where there are inherent purposes in the universe, albeit that there's no person who has those purposes. So it is a very interesting situation that you're getting in contemporary philosophy of mind. So just a final thought then before we go into some more interactive work. What sort of contribution does all of this make apologetically? Well, clearly these considerations by themselves don't establish the truth of Christianity. I'm someone who likes to think in terms of cumulative cases, so I certainly think this sort of thing contributes to a cumulative case for Christianity. For me, so I was an agnostic at the age of 19, and if I were to sort of lay out the different worldviews that I saw as live options and kind of how likely it was that I thought they were true, it might have looked something like this. And it seems to me that this kind of consideration that I've been talking about can eliminate one of those options, such that the other options kind of become more credible. Once one eliminates naturalism. And I think, and just going back to C.S. Lewis, who I mentioned at the start, certainly that's how things were for C.S. Lewis. It seems like the first step in his multi-stage journey to Christianity was becoming convinced that naturalism was false because it couldn't be squared with consciousness and reason. And so as I said, these considerations don't take us all the way to Christianity by any means, but I think they are an important plank in a kind of wider cumulative case.